Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And like I say, welcome to the show. We have an exciting one. It's aviation. Again, we had that, maybe a month or so ago, speaking with Todd Curtis. And tonight we have a fighter pilot for the first part of the show. And his name is Vincent Aiello. And he'll be on, like I said, the first hour. And if all goes well, we'll have a aviation correspondent, Tyler Rogaway, who has written recently about some UFO sightings. He will be on the second part of the show. And before all that, we have news as usual with Alejandro Rojas in just 1 minute. I will tell you that for those regular YouTube listeners and perhaps even some podcast subscribers, you may not be aware of this, but we had a show midweek, mid-show week, on last Friday with the Hynek brothers, Dr. J. Allen Hynek's two sons. We had Joel and Paul Hynek on, a very good show. We had some interesting people call in, and I'm sure you'll really enjoy it. That's for subscribers. It's as a podcast, and anyone can watch that on YouTube, so go check it out. That was done last Friday, and it's up on YouTube again and for subscribers. And that's enough. I do want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. And we are ready to roll. Alejandro, how are you?
Hello, hello, hello.
How are you this week?
Very good. That's so cool that you got, the gentleman from the Fighter Pilot podcast. In fact, I've got a link on the front page of my website to that podcast.
Yeah. No,
people can check that out.
Someone sent that to me, and I was fascinated, and I was very thrilled that Vincent was, come on the show talk about it. Because I would say, he's righteously a skeptic, but he was, fascinated enough to get in touch with David Fravor, who he actually knew, and interview him. Another really great interview. I'm glad you have that posted. It's a good one.
I'm dying to know what he thinks of Fravor too. This is so exciting that you have him on, just because it's interesting to know. I mean, Fravor is certainly very credible. His case is very compelling. He was a commander, so and of course all the other people, his colleagues who also witnessed all this event. It's interesting to know, what their colleagues think of all of this. So
that's right. Yeah.
Exciting.
Right.
So news.
No news.
So you and I have.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. So I was pausing to make sure I had the okay to continue on with UFO news.
Yes.
So, yeah. Again, we've got a story today from Pennsylvania, Penn Live, called "Pennsylvanian Spotted UFOs 77 Times in 2018. Did Aliens Visit Your Town?" The last part's, of course, a little goofy. But the point here is, yet again, we keep seeing these stories popping up. I think just last week there was 100 sightings in New York. I think it was it was not the New York Times, but another New York paper. And we're seeing these pop up all over the place. They're referencing the National UFO Reporting Center. However, they are inspired to write about all this because of Project Blue Book. The TV show.
Yep.
So, it's just really creating a lot of attention everywhere about, UFOs. And I think that it's just really interesting. I think this phenomena, of this show kind of opening people's eyes to that, to the fact that, even scientific investigators inside the Air Force felt that there was something to the phenomena, is really eye-opening to people, along with, of course, this information that there were pilots as well that had their own sightings. And there's some stuff in the news regarding some of that, or at least related stuff as well. So that's the Pennsylvania paper. I just pointed that out for mainly for that reason, that we keep getting these people looking into this.
Yeah, Project Blue Book, series has really stirred up a buzz in the UFO field community, at least.
It really has. Well, and now we know that it's stirring up a buzz everywhere else.
Yeah.
And this is what's funny. because the general public, we have, you know, they're very positive, you know, about the credibility of UFOs, and they reference the Pentagon Project, and, you know, they're treating it very seriously. But then when you look at, let's say, a UFO blog or a UFO forum, you know, all the a lot of the hardcore UFO researchers are upset. And, you know, oh, it's not accurate, but they've just gotten so negative. It's like, and I think that they like having their own niche. They don't get excited about the mainstream looking into the topic. Maybe they feel territorial, or, I mean, for me, you know, as a journalist and a writer, I would rather have the mainstream looking into it. So we have more credibility, more resources to look into what might be going on. But it's a really funny phenomenon. But we almost got this really with the Pentagon Project as well, and Lou Elizondo, because you would think, oh, wow, people are excited. Look, the Pentagon has this project. Lou Elizondo used to run it, wants to come out and help investigate UFO sightings. But no, they get all upset. No, he's got to be lying. He's got to be full of it. Rah, 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 rah. And so it is. There is this weird kind of disconnect. And I think they're really losing the point in that, you know, what they're, you know, pet project is, or what they're most enthusiastic about, is becoming much more mainstream and popular and easier for people to digest, which is pretty exciting, I think.
I wonder if that's part of it. I wonder if that's part of the I don't want to say anger or whatever it is, the negativity out there, is that it's becoming mainstream, and like they, you know, it's too mainstream for them to. Or
I guess,
or, I don't know.
I don't completely have it figured out either. You know, one of us, I think what we have to do, and there are people, sociologists and psychologists who are interested in this field. Maybe we need to talk to them and see if they can examine what this phenomena is.
Yeah, that is interesting.
You know, there is some news related to that as well, because some people are skeptical that the group that Elizondo worked for, the Advanced Aerospace Identification Program, what doesn't really exist, or at least they didn't do what Elizondo did, and that Elizondo's lying or misrepresenting all of that. And we do have some documents that just came out recently. They came out to the Federation of American Scientists and also to Nick Pope, who did FOIA requests for more information about ATIP. And they did get some information. So these documents list the products that were produced by ATIP, and the products being, in this case, the papers that came out of it. The papers are mostly along the lines of theoretical science around propulsion systems, such as warp drives, stargates, this sort of thing, and the potential for these sorts of things. But so they're interesting documents. None of them reference UFOs, but it is interesting that, at least in the document, it does kind of list it separately as advanced aerospace threat and identification, which of course Lou Elizondo has said that part of that program was not just to theorize but also to try to identify these unknowns, many of which of course Lou feels were unidentified, including one of those being the case in 2004 with the Nimitz Carrier Strike Group, with which you all are about to talk about, that being the main case we know about. In fact, we know very little to nothing about any other case except for the Nimitz one that ATIP had looked at and determined to be something unusual. I mean, it's just further confirmation that this organization did indeed exist, that it could possibly, and according to Lou, it does exist to this day, and they're continuing this sort of work, which, of course, is surprising because we never knew that before. We were always told for decades that the government has no interest in the UFO phenomenon, and here we have a Pentagon program was going on, even with people we had talked to, even with people we had interviewed, and we didn't even know that was happening. And I was even managing PR for a project that was being funded by this, and I didn't even know that when I was with MUFON. So it's an extraordinary situation. And here again, you know, projects like Elizondo and him coming out and Fravor coming out has really opened the door to the media being more accepting of and taking this whole thing very seriously. And also people in the aerospace industry taking it more seriously. People like Tiger Rogaway, who you're going to interview, a, you know, defense writer. He writes about advanced technology that is known, but him feeling more open to being able to talk about this, Fravor being all over the place. And then, you know, your guest tonight, I'm not sure, and maybe you could ask if he would have been as forthcoming or wanting to even talk on some weird guy's podcast about UFOs, you know, if it hadn't been for like Fravor and some of these other credible people with military backgrounds coming out and finally revealing that, you know, they've had these experiences and they believe there is a mystery here.
Right, right. You know, I've said, you know, many times that I don't think there's any part of our government that actually knows actually what it is. Do you feel the same way about that? I mean, that just...
It's hard to say, and I think you do make a good point. We have, of course, John Alexander, who was in Army Intelligence, and he got together a group of people in intelligence who also believe that UFOs pose a real mystery. They went looking for the secret keepers, and they didn't find any. And right. Essentially what they found, which maybe I think you should bring up tonight, is that people don't want to report anything. Just like in this report that came out about Nimitz, Fravor and the pilots, when they got back to the aircraft carrier, they were made fun of. People there, the intelligence debriefing guys had tinfoil hats on. Other people had tinfoil hats, made fun of them. You know, there was even, it was expressed some, you know, real frustration at the ridicule that they faced. And so they don't want to report these things. So that would, and so that's what Alexander says, is it's more kind of a conspiracy of incompetence. It's not really that they're hiding secrets, it's that they're just not organized enough or willing enough to take a strong look at this. On the flip side, we have documents that we've known to have had. You know, I've got a video out on this on Open Minds TV about military secrecy and UFOs. So we have these documents where they're looking at UFOs. They're sending these, they're flagging them with their, with, you know, these flags that essentially say this needs to go to the leadership. We need to take a serious look at these cases. Paul Dean, for instance, is a researcher out of Australia who's followed where these documents have gone, and they've gone to departments that are not well known, that close and open up under a different name. So at least there's somebody that was looking at these. How seriously were they taking it? Was it a group like ATIP that didn't have a lot of resources that maybe were able to examine them and write up some reports? That's probably most likely what they did, which is more along the lines of what you're talking about. They took these reports, they looked at them, saw what they could glean for them, can't really figure anything out, and that's about it. But of course, some people believe that there's somebody somewhere that were taking these reports and then also, you know, uncovering major secrets and keeping hurting people to make sure that they stay quiet, or even, you know, housing aliens in bunkers underground or something like that. I don't think really we have any evidence of that. Even with this recent Bob Lazar, you know, documentary, we have anecdotal stories from people, some of whom are somewhat somewhat credible, but don't really have any evidence to back that up. So at least for me, the scenario that you're expressing, that Alexander even talks about, is probably more accurate, that there could be some reports going on, some examination of reports, but no, you know, major discovery or hanger with UFOs or and aliens or something like that.
Right. One of the things that I'm going to bring up tonight is the, I know you're very well aware of this, is the chapter that from the Air Force Academy out of the physics book that talks about UFOs that J. Allen Hynek gave to Lee Spiegel. And so I put a copy up. There's a copy on the podcast UFO.com PDF. Anyone can check out there. 13 pages talks about UFOs. And once he started to make that public, it was removed from the book. The book was removed from.
No.
Okay. You clear
that's
it up.
That's not how the story goes. But you're along the same line. Something was changed.
Yeah.
So what had happened? That book was separate. So that book, you're right, it is really interesting. There were several versions of this chapter in this physics book that was taught at the Air Force Academy about UFOs. And it even speculated that perhaps we've been visited for thousands of years.
Right.
Speculating that, you know, UFOs may be here from other planets to check us out doing this or that. So a lot of speculation in this chapter, which is really interesting. And the Air Force Academy is in Colorado Springs. Well, the Denver Post got a hold of the fact that they had this chapter in there. It was about 1970, so about a year after Project Blue Book closed. And so there was a lot of scrutiny. People are like, what are you teaching this weird stuff about UFOs at the Air Force Academy? So that's when they pulled that chapter. The Lee Spiegel thing is interesting, though, and it does go back to what we were talking about earlier. The Lee Spiegel thing was he was going to do an article about how the Air Force reports UFOs and that they are reporting UFOs, and they flag them with these that there's this section that was in the JNAP document. It was also in the Air Force documents that said, here's how you report UFOs. Well, when Lee first went there, John Greenwald from Project Blue Book showed him where to go to see these files. They were there. He started writing his story for the Huffington Post. And then when he went back just a couple days later, they were gone.
That's right.
And
that's how that went, right?
And in the meantime, he had, called up the Air Force for comment about these files. He then called him back and said, where did those go? And they said, oh, we were cleaning out the files, and that was just something. So either it was a huge coincidence or, his inquiries did have an effect. But one really important thing is that, and this is all in our video, actually, that I was just referencing, is that what it was replaced by, what is in its place, are a different set of instructions for submitting important intelligence sightings of other things. It doesn't specify UFOs in this document, and it's called OPREP. It's a different level of OPREP reporting. And that actually is what they use to report UFOs, and there are OPREP reports when you go look for those, and that did give a clue for different UFO researchers to look for these OPREP flagged unknowns. And sure enough, through FOIA, there have been a few found, especially UFO sightings over nuclear facilities where they don't know what they are, or others where you do have these UFO reports that were escalated. We don't know what happened to them, but they still used that OPREP system that did indeed replace that JNAP 146 set of instructions that were older.
Well, I'm so glad you set that straight, because guess who's listening who just texted me? Lee Spiegel.
Lee.
So if there's anything you want to say to him, feel free to.
Lee. Good work, buddy. Yeah. He's always doing some awesome work. So
right.
Good work on that, dude.
Yeah. Alejandro, thank you so much, and we'll be talking to you next week.
All right. It's been a pleasure. Talk to you later.
All right. Take care. All right, everyone. Our guest tonight, Vincent Aiello, he became enamored with aviation while attending an air show at a very young age, 8 years old. And so that was his goal, to become a pilot. He has flown mostly the FA-18 Hornet and Super Hornet, which is like a rocket strapped to your back, a F-16 Fighting Falcon. And he was also a Top Gun instructor and an Air Wing Operations Officer. Now he has Fighter Pilot Podcast, which is a very well-listened-to podcast. We're going to be talking a little bit about that, but also about his recent interview. Welcome to the show, Vincent.
Thank you, Martin. It is my pleasure to be here.
Yes, I appreciate the fact that you'd actually come on a UFO show. And currently, you're a commercial pilot. And I want to tell you a story real quickly. I have told it on this show quite a while ago, because it was about a year ago or so. I was flying on, I think it was United Airlines, and there was a gentleman I started talking to. We had a great conversation, and he ended up, he was jump seating to another location. I think that's what you call it, if I remember right. And so he was a commercial pilot, but he said he used to fly F-15s. And the conversation came up. I asked him if he had heard anything about the Pentagon and researching UFOs. A few months earlier, I think it was February, just after that first part of last year. And he said, no, I hadn't heard about it. And then he turns to me and he goes, but I know they're real. And I said, whoa. I said, what? Explain. I just want to hear what you got to say. And he said he was flying somewhere over the Midwest. And all of a sudden, his cockpit started getting like a green light in it. And he looked all around, and behind him, I know you don't call it the backseat or whoever they call that. I think he said he was asleep, and I've heard that's impossible, but, you know, maybe he was dozing off or whatever. But he didn't wake him up if that was the case. It was only him that saw it. And then it got so bright that it filled his entire cockpit and, you know, made him really scared. And he called. There was nothing, you know, nothing registered on radar. But then he said it just shot off. And so I asked him if he'd be willing to talk about it even anonymously on a UFO show. And he said, no way. He said, no, not in my position. So how do you feel? You're a commercial pilot now, and you have no problem talking about UFOs and not worried about it in any type of way?
No, I'm not, because I personally have not had any experience with anything that I've seen while flying that I could not identify. I know there are people who have, and so I became involved with this, as you said earlier, with my podcast when I interviewed Commander Fravor. And I would just like to add, just for the sake of it, the terminology. So the jump seat is up in the cockpit with the actual pilots flying.
He was most likely what we call deadheading.
Very good.
Yeah. Yes.
And I don't know if the Air Force calls the backseater a WISO, but that's what we call him in an F-18, the weapon systems operator. Yeah. And of course, in an F-14, it was a RIO, radar intercept officer. And I, you know, Martin, I am loath to say that anyone is wrong, because I've not walked in their shoes. But I will say that I've been drowsy in an airplane, a military airplane. I've never fallen asleep. And if I were flying with a backseater who did doze off, generally any little thing that's different would usually startle them. You don't sleep so deeply that you wouldn't come to if something out of the ordinary happened. I think your body just almost requires it. So I have some difficulty with that story.
Yeah.
The fact that he is unwilling to discuss it seems a little convenient, because maybe he was caught in a exaggeration. But again, I've never had such an experience, so I'm not prepared to say that anyone who has is either lying or hiding something or anything else.
Now, in general, I know you did this. You did this podcast with David, but in general, does the topic of UFOs ever come up in the academy or anywhere else? Is that ever discussed?
Well, I did not go to the Naval Academy, okay, so I can't speak to that. I was a ROTC midshipman at UCLA, and it doesn't really come up, because there's just no concrete discussion about it. That when it comes up with someone like Commander Fravor, then the answer is usually, as it was stated earlier, the tin hats and the silliness, because we are, I would categorize as a class of people, fighter pilots and air crewmen, we are used to being in control and knowing our environment and our surroundings and understanding what we're doing in a moment. And when we can't understand it, we search for defense mechanisms like laughter or ridicule, because how else do we admit that there's confusion or uncertainty? So that is, in my opinion, a very logical response to him, because when he returned, as I understand the situation, he walked into what we call CIVIC, or the Carrier Information Center, and he told them what he saw, and people didn't know what to do with that. He didn't know what to do with it. He was not sure what he saw. And so it's just like a person who nervously laughs when they are caught in, well, that's a bad example, because again, I'm not implying lying, but as a tic that people have during certain things that are happening, maybe before a fight happens, or, you know, people who laugh when they're really scared or something else. I think it's just a normal, quote unquote, normal reaction for people in our line of business to make fun and ridicule and try to explain it away that way, or maybe not even so much explain it away, but just deal with it that way, because a lot of people just don't know how else to handle.
Sure. If you personally were flying yourself and actually saw something you couldn't understand, what would be the protocol? What would you do if you saw something unusual?
Well, in my previous capacity as a military pilot, I would try to make sure my tape recorder was on. Mm-hmm. If I had a wingman, I would search for justification from him. Maybe justification is not the right word, but I would point out to my wingman what I was seeing and what did he or she think it could be, so that it could be corroborated, maybe is a better word. And I would try to get whatever information I could, but it's difficult to ask, or I should say it's not difficult to ask that, it's difficult to answer that, because it's like asking people, well, what would you do in the face of a bully? And we all say, oh, I'd stand up to him, or I would do this or that. And in reality, when a fight's about to happen, people respond very differently. The fight or flight response is real. Yeah. And so I would like to say that I'd be cool and do all the things I just did, but in reality, I might scream like a little girl and run the other way. I don't know. And in my current capacity as an airline pilot, of course, it'd be easy to just reach over to the captain, in my case, as a first officer, and say, do you see that? What does that look like to you? Hey, air traffic control, are you seeing anything next to us similar to the story your F-15 friend told you? So it's hard to answer that, but I'd like to think I'd be cool about it.
And what do you think about, is there anything set in place to report something like that, that may not seem like a danger? I know there's always a way to report a danger, but something that may not seem like a danger that was unusual, or would you tend to want to keep that to yourself?
Oh, I think I would be willing to report it regardless of the ridicule I would receive, because in that line of work, you get ridiculed for almost anything, and it's a little bit dog-eat-dog, cutthroat, and I've, in the past, on my podcast discussed why it is that we do that. And I think, frankly, it's because we need to hold each other to such high standards that it's just our way of kind of picking at each other once in a while, or frankly, all the time, to see, is there any weakness? Is there any chinks in the armor? Because it's basically unacceptable. When you are landing on the aircraft carrier at night in pitching seas, you have to be 100% on your game. Boy. No alibis, no excuses, no weaknesses, no doubts. And so in a situation like that, I'd like to think that I would say, look, this is what I saw. I don't know what else to tell you. You can tease me if you want, because if it's not about this, it'll be about something else in a few minutes. So it just comes with the territory. But yeah, I'd like to think I would respond and report.
Yes. Okay. Well, we're going to go into our first break here, and we'll be right back. So this is Martin Willis, and my guest is Vincent Aiello, and we'll be right back right after these messages. So let's say we'll talk about off topics during the YouTube break here. And
okay.
And so I can't imagine what it's like to fly a Hornet or Super Hornet. You know, like I said, you know, introducing, it's like strapping a rocket to your back. The G-forces and all that, what does it take to get used to all that? I mean, it must be intense training for a long time.
It is. Now, if you ever watch videos of the Blue Angels when they take up the local reporter when they arrive at a location for an air show, the reporter generally gets sick. Yep. Not always, but a lot of them do.
Yep.
And they don't tolerate the G-forces very well. And I mention that because it's nothing like that. We crawl, walk, run. We start off with a low wing propeller trainer that we build maybe 100 hours of flight experience in, and then we move to jets, and then we begin to fight in the jets doing aerobatic maneuvers and rolls and chasing each other around. Then we land on the carrier, and then we move to, in my case, the F-18, and you don't just walk into it. Like anything, you build a tolerance, and in some ways that's a good thing, like pulling G's and flying. Of course, in other ways it can be a bad thing, like people who build a tolerance to alcohol and need to drink more and more to get a buzz. And yeah. So it's just thankfully something that you get used to, really.
What about simulator time? Is there a lot of that before you actually get in behind the stick?
Yes, the simulators are used to build procedural knowledge so that when you get in the airplane, you're not floundering around and wondering what to do next. So typically, the course of training begins with self-study and then academic instruction in a classroom and then simulators and then finally the airplane. Because by the time you get there, they don't want to waste everyone's time and the fuel and the range space to have someone fly who's not ready. It's very convenient and simple to practice in a simulator where they can critique you if your procedures are not sound.
Do they actually remind you of how much one of those babies cost? A lot?
Oh, sure. Quite often. Yeah, I was always told that the F-18 Hornet was $35 million. So I tried to take that
to scratch it.
Part. Well, yeah. As long as you don't scratch it for reasons that you are messing something up, you know, on your own volition. If you're following procedures and something happens, well, then you're still doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Now, is it classified? Is the speed classified on those?
No, not at all.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Well known that the F-18 is advertised to do about Mach 1.8. And I will tell you, the only time I ever got close to that, 90 seconds, is Mach 1.6. And that was in about a 50 or 60 degree dive with no pylons or external stores on the aircraft. And I started at about 50,000 feet. And it was all I could to keep watching the Earth get bigger and bigger, thinking, how fast is this thing really going to go? So it's a theoretical speed limit. And
yeah,
what's more protected are some of the, what they call energy lines at different altitudes when they compare them to other aircraft, because then you start to see advantages and disadvantages. And so you see some of the more classified stuff there. But otherwise, it's pretty common that the F-18 will do 1.8, and I think an F-16 will do, in fact, I know it'll do over Mach 2.
Amazing. And I know the fuel consumption, I think they call it pounds instead of gallons, but it just it just click, 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 just going away. It goes fast.
It's like being dumped out of a big old giant bucket. That's right.
Yeah. All right. Welcome back. This is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO. My guest is Vincent Aiello, and we're talking aviation, and we're talking UFOs as well. And he was during the YouTube break, he was just telling me what it was like. So getting back to speaking with David Fravor, you actually knew David before, right? And was he part of some TV series or something?
Yes, he and I met in, I want to say it was 2003 on the USS Nimitz. And then between 2003 and 2005, we were in the same air wing, both based at Naval Air Station Lemoore, California, just about 30 miles south of Fresno in the middle of the state. And we would see each other around base, but because of the rank difference, he was a executive officer and then the commanding officer, and I was a rank or two below behind. I wouldn't say we were friends, but we were acquaintances. Mm-hmm. And I was on the carrier the day in November of 2004 when the episode happened off the coast of Mexico. And on our deployment in 2005, that is when the PBS carrier TV crew came out and spent the entire deployment with us and followed a number of people around, including some squadron mates of mine and Commander Fravor.
Now, what do you think about that whole encounter and also David's story? It's quite compelling, wouldn't you say?
It is very compelling, Martin. And I will tell you that the answer to your first question is, I don't know. Prior to that interview, I would have done as I intimated earlier and probably just made funny or a joke about whatever they thought they saw. And I'll be blunt. I thought anyone who believed in UFOs or at least outer space vehicles, you know, coming into our atmosphere were just wacky guys that just had an agenda or something else. And that attitude changed after my interview with Commander Fravor.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're having a little bit of a Skype issue here. I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah. No problem.
So I didn't hear the last part of what you just said.
Okay. Well, I was saying that my preconceived notion had changed after my interview with Commander Fravor because he did not fit the mold that I had built wrongly, I would say, of people who have these beliefs. And when he told his story, and I asked him point blank, what do you think it is? And he said, I don't know. It could be a super secret black project from the government or someone else's government, or it could be from outer space. I decided that that is an interesting conundrum to be in, because usually as fighter pilots, and we like to know, as I said earlier, our surroundings and what is real and what is not. And I think it's a mystery to him, and I don't know what to think either.
I should announce that next week on this show, we're having Robert Powell, and the whole discussion is going to be about the Nimitz and Nimitz encounter. He's done some great research on that. The description of the vehicles, and then at one time them seeing so many of them, is just bizarre, and they look just like Tic Tacs, except they look like they had little antennas on them. No source wing, any type of wing or any type of visual or detected propulsion system. And the way that it just, you know, was in one spot and then instantly was in another spot, and it's just so bizarre. I mean, if it's not from outer space, you know, wherever it's from, it's bizarre. Whatever it is,
right?
And then, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I found, and in fact, I used in his episode a little pre-roll snippet of his discussion. But I found that the part that he said that it did not seem to comply with the laws of physics that we take for granted on Earth to be very compelling, and so that was part of what I used in the opening bumper, if you will.
Oh, yeah, and, that's right. Yeah.
Yep. And I don't know. But I do find it interesting that the Aegis class cruiser that was there had been tracking these for a period of time. And then that they were even out there after Commander Fravor's event when he landed. His squadron mates went out right after that. And so it's not just, again, one person who might have an agenda or wants the notoriety or just thought it'd be funny to make something up. There is evidence elsewhere, but then you turn around and say, well, why is none of that evidence available anymore? The Princeton's tapes, the tapes from Commander Fravor, I guess there is some imagery, but it might be from the off the coast of Florida, I guess, in 2015. I'm not totally sure where it came from, but it is convenient, I think, to assume that maybe there is a cover-up or something else because information is misplaced. But on the other hand, I could make a case, having lived the life, that it's very difficult to keep track of various things, even if they are important, because they get used by another aircrew. In the case of the tapes he was trying to save, he mentioned that in his interview, that someone else might have taken them out and used them the next day, and it just records over what was already there. It's hard to know. It really is hard to know.
And how unusual is that they actually had them, you know, go out and check to see what it was? Is that a typical thing that would happen if they saw some unknown object in a certain area?
Certainly, especially if we were deployed away from our own shores. So I would say that it is not uncommon, but it is interesting that it was just 100 miles off the coast of Mexico. But if we are ever on deployment somewhere, Martin, and the world with the situation as it is today, we don't always know who intends us harm, that we have alerts that are ready. And if there's something that people don't understand, they will launch aircraft to go and identify what is out there.
I see. One of the things that doesn't get brought up too much in when people are talking about this case is that people have seen things like this for a long, long time. It's not something, you know, when a number of people will say, hey, look, you know, this could be some experimental craft. Well, that's fine. Well, what about 50 years ago when they were seeing, you know, almost identical type things happening? You know, I mean, that's where it gets even more of a mystery. And that's what keeps me doing the show. It's a mystery.
I agree, because it would be very convenient if we could look at something from 50 years ago and say, oh, that turned out to be the F-117, right?
Right.
That's true. And again, you never really know what motives people have or what is incentivizing them to either report something or to not report something, as the case may be. And I do know that there are different governmental initiatives that could be, I guess, supposedly misconstrued, depending on what it is they're doing. I, of course, have to be careful, because even though I'm retired from the military, I'm still bound by classification laws. But it's very possible that things that the military was doing but not admitting to is something that people misunderstood. And let's not lose track of the fact that we call something a UFO because it is unidentified.
Right.
That does not necessarily imply that it's from outer space.
I know other, you know, some organizations are using UAP and other, you know, ways to talk about the subject because of the tainted, you know, UFO people just assume means alien. A lot of people do assume that it means alien. So I probably picked a bad name for my podcast, but it's too
late. What is UAP? I've not heard of that, actually.
Oh, aerial. Oh, boy. unidentified aerial phenomena.
Okay.
Or right. Very close to that, if I got it off a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. No problem.
And so that's another one that's being used, but still, and you'll see that there's a few, like I said, a few organizations that will use that. And actually, when it comes to pilots reporting that NICAP, I believe is that's what they use for that term. Now, I have a question for you. A lot of people are seeing, especially in the last several years, but going back really far, but they're seeing black triangles. As far as UFO sightings, that's what we hear a lot about recently. But, you know, Lee Spiegel was actually listening to the show, had quite a sighting back in, I think it was 1978 or thereabouts. And people have seen them for many, many years. And a lot of speculation is that they are, you know, secret military aircraft. A lot of people also report that they make no sound when they go overhead. Some people say there is a humming. Some people feel that there's some type of electrical charge. I've heard that. Sometimes ignitions in cars go off, things like that. Do you think it's possible that there is military, secret military craft that would be flying for so long? Or is that, you know, do you think, I mean, I consider it just a mystery myself. I have no idea. But what is your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are complex because on the one hand, you take a project like the SR-71 or the F-117 or the B-2, which all began very classified and then came out later, if you will, as acknowledged programs. And now you can know all kinds of things about just about all of them. And I also am mindful that it's almost hard enough for one person to keep a secret. Anytime you have more than one person, a secret is virtually impossible to keep. And so so to answer your question, I do believe there are projects the government is working on. Whether one could exist for 50 years without it being acknowledged and without the secret to get out, that to me seems less plausible than maybe at one point whatever people saw turned out to be the F-117 or the B-2, and whatever we're seeing now just has not been acknowledged yet. And so there again, it's very difficult to say with any authority, and it's just my own opinion, that I'm virtually certain that there are aircraft that the military is flying that we don't know about, you and I, and maybe someday we will, maybe we never will. And if so, then they have a pretty darn good system in place for keeping it under wraps, because if you think about the various locations in Nevada that began as very covert, if you will, and now are relatively well known, it seems, and other projects that have been leaked or spilled or intentionally released, I don't know of anything, frankly, that was developed and still not told about, if you will. And if I did, I guess I couldn't tell you anyway, but I don't, to make it simple. Yeah. And so I think it is possible that there are aircraft out there being employed, whether they're manned or unmanned, I don't know. And could they be using different propulsion sources? And could it have an electromagnetic pulse type impact on electronics near it? Sure. But I don't know of any.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you willing to, I actually put the phone number up there. So anyone can call in now. We're only about 11 minutes. We're going to be going to a break and taking in another guest. So if anyone has a question they'd like to ask Vincent, please give a call now. That number's up on the screen. And that's 603, not that number that's up there. Let's see. We had a problem with our last call-in number, so it's a 603-967-4030. And the number you see up on the screen is wrong. Hang on just a minute, please. Okay. There you go. Anyway, I had something I was going to say, but the number thing.
No problem.
Yeah, when you are up in a jet and you're at, say, 30,000, 40,000 feet, somewhere around there, I know from experience myself, I've mentioned on this show that I was a flight attendant, you know, years ago. So, and I've been up in the cockpit. You can see for miles and miles and miles and miles. And so you would think that if something is coming into the Earth's atmosphere and flying around, you'd be able to, you know, with all the, how many hours do you have?
In military aircraft, 3,800 and approximately 1,000 in civilian.
Yeah. So there you go. I mean, that's, you know, I don't know how many days that is, but, you know, you're out there, you know, you're usually your eyes are out there. I know with autopilot, you don't always have to be, you know, concentrating, but still, you would think that you would see something. Have you ever been in a situation where anybody talks about they had a sighting, they didn't know what it was?
Only on the November of 2004 episode on the Nimitz.
That's it.
And even then, I don't recall being part of any discussions. I imagine I was going about my life as I normally would on the ship, and someone might have made a funny about it or pointed out, you know, the next day on our flight schedule called the air plan, once in a while on the back where all the notes are, there's a little extra real estate. So they'll put a cartoon of something recent or relevant. And for the next two or three days, of course, there were all these cartoons about Men in Black and all these other things. And so we might have made jokes about that. But truthfully, I don't really remember anything out of the ordinary or people talking about it. So no, I have no experience with that, unfortunately.
Well, I was wondering. As you're a commercial pilot, probably that the you know when you said you know probably the captain you're sitting next to, that conversation wouldn't come up even if that person saw something at one point. You know, it'd be a strange conversation to get into, wouldn't it? Normally.
It would be, because again, airline pilots are much like the military pilots. We like to have the answers because a lot rides on us, and we like to be in command of things and to be knowledgeable. And it's difficult for people to admit they don't know what it is they saw or are seeing. And so I don't know if that's a pride thing per se, but I assume, I don't know of any, but I assume there are airline pilots out there who have said, hey, I saw something and I don't know what it was.
Right, right. Now, you know, you've heard this a million times, I'm sure, that there's 1,000 hours of boredom for every 15 seconds of terror or something like that, right? Isn't that how that goes? Or
I don't know the exact ratio, but that sounds about right, except when you are deployed in the Navy and at night you have to land on the carrier. Then I would say it's more like an hour and a half of boredom, depending on your mission, and about 60 seconds maybe of terror, because for the last minute you're about to land, it can be, depending on environmental conditions, it can be quite sporting.
Right, right. We have a caller calling in.
Great.
We'll take the call. And caller, welcome to the show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
It sounds like I'm calling every week now. This is Adam calling from Florida.
Hi there. How are you?
How's it going?
Good, good.
Listen, hi. Could you ask your guests, are gliders, are they normally seen at night? Or I just saw something, as you mentioned, UAP, like fly over. I'm in, on the east coast of Florida, and I'm by the airport, so I'm not sure.
Okay, what is the question again?
I think Martin's asking if gliders mostly fly during the day or at night. Yes. And so I could hear the question. I did not catch your name, but hello from Florida.
My name is Abner.
I'm not a glider pilot. Abner. Hello, Abner. I'm not a glider pilot. I've not seen gliders fly at night except at an air show one time when a glider was towed up intentionally with lights and pyrotechnics, which was quite mesmerizing. And I went to a night air show here at the Marine Corps Air Station Miramar some years back. It was quite fun. And other than that, as I understand, most of them fly in the daytime because the gliders are generally unpowered, many of them. Some have avionics and radios, but some of them are just old school airframe cables and pulleys with a stick and rudder and some pitot-static instruments, which don't require power. And so to fly at night, you would either need to hold a flashlight to those or have some other system so you don't get lost or run into something you shouldn't. So as to my knowledge, most glider flying is in the daytime.
Also, don't you use the thermal updrafts in a glider?
Generally speaking, yes. You can also fly with wind updrafts, which is why you see hang gliders oftentimes at coastal cliffs.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Is the way the wind comes off the ocean and goes up those cliffs, it can keep hang gliders aloft for long times.
All right. All right. Thanks for the call.
All right. Thank you.
All right. All right. So, we're out to our break in about 4 minutes.
Okay.
I do want to make sure, though, before you leave, that people can find your podcast, and it's a good one. And so go ahead and give that information out, if you would.
I appreciate that, Martin. Any podcast player you have should list us. Just look for the Fighter Pilot Podcast. But you can also listen on our website, which is, of course, fighterpilotpodcast.com. And we are on all the usual social media, Facebook, Instagram, Patreon, Twitter, YouTube. I recently began a Discord channel, and I may be even forgetting some because I've been responding to the interest in the podcast and going where people have asked us to go. So there could be more, but if you look for the Fighter Pilot Podcast, we show up in many different venues.
All right. Now, after you interviewed David Fravor, do you have any more of an interest in looking into aviation regarding UFOs, you know, encounters? There's so many of them.
I understand that, Martin, and I feel a little bit badly in this venue saying no, but the truth is no.
Sure.
And I say that because the podcast is about military aircraft, and I always say it's about the aircraft, the weapon systems, and most importantly, the people. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I had a compelling people story, and many of my listeners had asked me to interview Commander Fravor. And so I willingly obliged because he's a friend anyway, and it was good to see him. And I would like to be able to say it interests me more and to pursue it, but it's a little bit like golf. I've never considered myself a particularly good aviator because I don't play golf. And so I find it difficult to pursue it because there's just no interest there.
Yeah.
Could there be an interest developed into this? Sure. But there is so much that I'm looking to do with my podcast, and there are so many other topics that I'll probably continue to move on. And if at some point it circles back around or an opportunity presents itself, well, sure, I won't shun it. But it is not something I intend to actively continue to pursue.
Sure. And I didn't actually mean that in the podcast way. I just meant that there is a number of aviation-related UFO encounters. There's actually been some, you know, that I'm going to be talking about with Tyler Rogaway. There was one in Ireland just a few weeks ago. I think we have a call coming in. Let's see about that. And we just have a couple of minutes.
Okay.
Caller, you're on the line here, and your first name and where are you calling from?
Brent from North Carolina.
Hi there. Welcome to the show. We have someone else trying to call in, too. So you have a question for our guest tonight?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask him what his opinion, the recent gun fighter pilot or the gun video of the UAP that rotates and tilts, and you can hear the pilots talking about it, just what his opinion on that was. Thanks.
That is a nickname. It's called the Gimbal UFO. That was
the Gimbal, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Hello, Brent. And thanks for your question. I don't know very much about it. I did use clear video, forward-looking infrared, of that episode to provide a what I call behind-the-scenes video on my YouTube channel recently. And I used it mainly to explain what my aviation aficionado listener base was seeing on the FLIR display itself. And in fact, I incorrectly identified it as the Commander Fravor episode, and I believe it was the Gimbal one instead. And there again, when you look at the imagery, it is perplexing. I don't know what they were seeing. I don't know how to explain or justify what they said or saw. So it's a mystery to me. And I did not watch the entire bit. I don't know what's available on YouTube, if everything from start to finish is available, but the little bits that I listen to, they're responses like, check that out, dude, and wow, it's rotating, that all sounded very authentic. Pilots, right. At least for me, I'm not a good actor, I have learned, and I have a newfound respect for actors and radio hosts like you, Martin, and others who do put themselves out in front of people to be interpreted and judged, frankly. And so to me, they sounded very authentic, and I think they weren't sure what they saw either. So I don't know, is unfortunately your answer, Brent.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. So why don't you hang in there, and I'm going to go to break right now. So this is Martin Willis. My guest is Vincent Aiello, and we'll be back hopefully with Tyler Rogaway. You know, when did you actually make the decision that you were going to go for this was going to be your thing?
All right. Well, as Martin stated at the top of the show, I was taken to an air show at the tender age of 8 years old by my stepfather, who had just joined the family. And his father had taken him to air shows as a child. And what my stepfather enjoyed about them was the technology. He specifically remembers they had an AIM-9 Sidewinder, which is a heat-seeking missile, on display. And one of the people explaining it held up a cigarette lighter, or the cigarette itself, I don't recall, and the missile growled and followed it, and it created an impression in my stepfather's head that he always just enjoyed, because he's a technology aficionado. So when he came into the family, he took us to a show. It was at the Naval Air Station in Point Magoo, California, just north of Malibu, and he enjoyed still at that point in his life looking at the technology. But for me, I became smitten with the pilots, between the swagger of the pilots themselves and the airplanes that they flew and the noise. And my two older brothers and I began to fly remote control airplanes back when they weren't so popular as they quote unquote drones are now. And so somewhere along the way, I decided this was what I wanted to do with my life. And in high school, I tried real hard. I was not accepted to the Naval Academy, but I was accepted into an ROTC program. And so I was able to earn a degree from UCLA and a commission into the Navy. And I was able to select for flight school. And in flight school, did sufficiently well enough to earn jets. And after jets, earned the F-18 and stayed in the Navy for almost 25 years. Accrued 3,800 flight hours and just loved every minute of it. Had a really good time. Over 700 carrier landings on 5 deployments, plus a bonus 6th deployment on the ground in Afghanistan. And along the way, was married, had 3 children, moved many times, and I have no regrets. I enjoyed my career immensely, and I know my children, although they were sad when I would deploy, they also think fondly of our time in the military and the friends we had and the locations where we lived.
Wow. Wow. Hi, is this Tyler?
Yeah, this is Ty.
Hey. Hi, Ty. You are on, you're live right now. All right, welcome back. We actually have 2 guests on, Vincent and Tyler Rogaway. He's on the phone. He's joining us. You two can meet via the internet here. And Tyler, why don't you give your background, if you would, to the listener?
Yeah, good to be with you guys, and you got to bear with me. I'm just getting over a cold here, so
yeah.
I might sound like I'm Kermit the Frog, okay? So hang there with me. But I run a website called thewarzone.com. We do everything defense, all spectrums of military technology, foreign policy, and sort of where those two nexus where those two things meet. So really it's defense reporting, has to do with everything from secretive programs to, what's going on in the world at any given time. So that's sort of my background and where I come from on this.
Great. And, Vincent, I don't know if you want to hang out a little while and,
sure, I'd be happy to.
Okay. Yeah. That's great. Thank you. And, so Tyler,
and if I,
go ahead.
Familiar with your website and I'm impressed.
Oh, hey, thanks so much, man. Greatly appreciate it. It's definitely a passion project, and we have a lot of fun with it. But it takes up a lot of time, but we love what we do.
There you go.
Yeah, and it's very busy. It's a very busy website. And you want to give that out? It's the drive, but it's the War Zone. Is that how does that work?
Yeah. so we're part of thedrive.com, which is a transportation vertical, but we have our own URL at thewarzone.com, and that will take you right to our own landing page, and you can see what we're up to and scroll through some of the older articles as well.
And so, Tyler, the guest that I have on now, Vincent Aiello, he has the Fighter Pilot podcast, and we were actually talking about, he interviewed David Fravor, who had the encounter, it's titled now the Nimitz Encounter, back in 2004. Are you familiar with that particular sighting?
Yeah, intimately, especially over the last year since this thing really blew open. Definitely an incredible encounter, an incredible account. And it's great that we're hearing a little bit more about it every single day.
Yes, and the podcast, I listened to the podcast that we're speaking about with Vincent and David Fravor. It's very good. And a lot of things are revealed in it that normally you wouldn't hear him say on any other show or whatever, because he's talking to another pilot. And so it's very interesting. And if you haven't heard it, I'd say check it out. It's good. So Tyler, you have written about UFOs. Have you had any ridicule for doing that? It seems like that's kind of the topic tonight. People are talking about how David Fravor was harassed, and there was you know, a number of things. I think we have a pilot actually calling in by this signal here. So we have a caller joining us here. Hello, caller. Your first name, where are you calling from?
My first name is Commander Cobra. I'm calling from someplace in the continental United States. How are you tonight, Mr. Martin?
Hey there. So, Commander Cobra, military pilot. That's the subject, and good timing for calling in. Thanks for calling.
Hey, my pleasure.
So let me tell you, who have you been listening to the show? I know you.
No, I'm in a MCOM situation. I am total radio blackout where I'm at right now.
Is that right? Okay. So we have Vincent Aiello. He has the Fighter Pilot podcast. He's here with us, and also Tyler Rogoway, who writes for the War Zone. Would I say that, Tyler? Is that the right way to say that, or do you say the Drive?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. No problem. That's good to go.
Yeah.
And actually, I've been on Commander Cobra's show quite a few couple times.
Oh, have you?
So we
yes.
We have.
Yeah, I consider Tyler one of my friends. I'm not sure if identify me as the same, but I think him is one of my friends.
Ah. Okay.
We definitely have similar interests. That's for sure.
Yeah. So Cobra, thanks for calling in. Do you have a question for either the Vincent or Tyler in particular?
I actually have a question for both. Vincent and Tyler, good evening. Well, the one thing I would like to start out with is to Tyler. Tyler, in the last few weeks, you have been really having a great run with the stories on the page. I look forward to it. It's almost a daily event for me to go through and see what's updated. You and Joe have been doing your normal excellent job. I'm curious if you have picked up a lot of response from the Air Force in particular and pilots in general on your coverage that you've been putting on the F-35 and some of the other, I would say, transitional issues. One of your latest parts talking about the light attack aircraft probably not being built.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Every day, those procurement pieces that we do, which are pretty hard-hitting, you know, we don't hold anything back. We get a lot of feedback from everybody, from people that are hands-on in the Pentagon to people that have had just an interest in it, you know, on a day-to-day basis. And that's definitely actually how, you know, we develop a lot of our sources are just from people that are interested and, you know, have something to share, something to say, you know, just like to talk to us about what we write about on a daily basis a little bit further. But, yeah, definitely. All those things are big right now. Obviously, there's a lot of money pouring into the DOD with Trump's larger budget. We'll see if that continues this year. But, you know, it's especially on the what we can tell also on the black side, on the classified realm, you know, that whole world is going to just be ballooning, especially in the next couple of years as those dollars that have been invested continue to mature. So we're going to see a lot of new things showing up. And really, I mentioned this on a lot of the, when I do, you know, shows about UFOs, especially, or anything like that, is that people have to realize what they're going to see in the sky just as bystanders daily basis is going to change in the next 5 to 10 years drastically with unmanned warfare and new concepts, new technologies that are being developed. So when you think and you see something maybe you don't understand at first, there's going to have to be some knowledge, some self-education about what really is out there potentially that, you know, maybe has a different origin than maybe what you jump to if you're into this subject matter. And, you know, so all that goes into it. But yeah, definitely, we always get a lot of feedback on a daily basis on that stuff.
I'm going to come back in a second. Hey, Vincent, what's your call sign?
Jello.
Boy, your name sounds really familiar. What did you fly?
I flew the F-18 mainly. I had a stint flying the F-16 towards the end of my career.
What's your squadron?
Were you up there on Fallon for Top Gun?
Yes, I was an aggressor pilot at the time Naval Strike and Air Warfare Center in Fallon, Nevada. And sorry, what was the question?
I was going to ask you, what was your VT squadron that you went through for primary?
Primary was VT-2, the Dewar Birds.
Yeah, I was an instructor there from 92 to 96.
Well, anytime? Then we would have overlapped.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I remember when Martin said your name, I remember you. I'll have Martin connect us up offline, and I'll give you the big reveal. You'll probably remember. But I'm pretty sure you and I flew together, and I was pretty sure if you said Hornets, because I remember you went that way. Two Bears, Greg Beisbear was my one of my students, if you remember Greg. He is a Marine F-18 guy.
Greg, what was the name again?
Beisbear. Two Bears was his call sign.
Two Bears. No, I can't say I do, but my brain is getting worse as I age, so it's possible it's up in there somewhere. I just got to dust it off.
Yeah,
just come talk to me.
Pardon me.
Talk about getting old.
Why don't you tell the listening audience what David Fravor's name is?
Who did you ask that to?
I'm asking you, Vincent.
Oh, Sex is his call sign.
Yeah, because it's Sexual Fravors, David Fravors. That's where
you so, bet.
Nice.
Is that how this all works? You try to find something in their name that you can make
sometimes
a nickname.
Sometimes.
Out of? Yeah.
It's names, or it is something you've done, or something you resemble. And I say something deliberately. It could also be someone, especially movie characters.
You never want to be called
Crash. And sometimes,
right? Yeah.
I do know some. I know a Crash. I know a Crunch. I know a Skids. I knew a what was it? Bam Bam or Boom Boom? Yeah, it was Bam Bam. So
when
yeah,
you say you knew. Does
some
that
of those.
Mean he had one more Bam or?
No, yeah, it no. Just means we've lost touch. I also knew a Torch.
Pretty funny.
Yeah.
Command, do you have any other questions for either one of our guests here?
Yeah, Jello, on your case, what did you think of the footage that was released? Your opinions of what's come out, and do you think anything else is going to come out in the near future as promised?
The only footage I've seen was apparently from the, what did you call it? Not the Tic Tac. What was the other one, Martin?
The gimbal from Florida.
Gimbal.
I believe it was.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's the only one I've seen. So I haven't really had a chance to scrutinize too much video, but of the gimbal video that I looked at in order to make a YouTube video recently on my channel about the FLIR itself, frankly, not about UFOs, it looked pretty interesting. It was not clear to me that it was anything masquerading as something else. It looked like something I couldn't tell what it was. And I did not, as I stated a few moments ago, I did not watch the video beginning. So I don't know what else was involved, but I do know that either the pilot or the Wizzo tried different zoom modes and different polarity and the TV mode of the AT FLIR. And at no time did it look like, okay, now we can tell it's a whatever. It all looked pretty interesting, frankly.
All right, so my last thing, I guess it's for all three of you, because you gave me a little homework, Mr. Martin, as we were coming up for the show, and you asked me to look at the Air Force Academy's physics book where it talked about UFOs in the physics book in 68. Did you see the answer I posted back to you?
I briefly did it. I had to leave early, so I didn't. I'll check it out.
I guess in general, I'm going to ask the three of you to discuss this, and I'm going to actually try to put the app on so I can hear the answer off air, and I look forward to talking to all three of you again real soon. Tyler and Joe have had an extremely interesting run of discussions of things that were flying that they couldn't identify, and they don't appear to be extraterrestrial. They appear to be projects that are out flying, and I'm sure that Joe has got some insights that as well, where he was spending and operating some of his time, some sensitive aircraft flew. I postulate to you, Mr. Martin, that one of the reasons that was in there is that the Air Force was using and actively using UFOs as a way to cover in a form of deception. It's a documented policy that they had in the 60s and 70s, advanced aircraft designs, that they kind of co-opted the interest, and they put a lot of information out there to throw people off. And I'm curious what your guests think about that, and if that was the reason why they spoke about it. I had some other information there, but I'm curious what they think of that reaction to that.
Which one of you want to take that? Either one of you.
I'll grab that one. Okay. That's an area that we are going to be really looking into in the future, and we're actually looking into it right now based on a lot of the information and a lot of the initiatives that are coming to light and have come to light in the last year. That is definitely something that I think is just like very much under-regarded in the UFO community as far as the relationship between, you know, dark programs and, for instance, the CIA and everybody else who had assets that they obviously did not want to have disclosed. And what a great cover where anybody that mentions, hey, I saw this weird thing and it looked like nothing I've seen before, and you just get laughed at. You know, there's no credibility there from the start. That's an incredible asset or incredible embedded, like, you know, norm to have in our society if you're trying to keep things that fly secret. Now, does that mean that, you know, that they have the ability to do anti-gravity propulsion and everything else? I mean, that's a whole nother topic. But I think that keeping the perpetuating the myth side of UFOs, right, and keeping our society really, acclimated to laughing at this topic is a very important thing to very powerful people that are within the defense industrial complex. And we know that, like you said, we have documentation on that. That isn't my opinion. That isn't your opinion. And I think going forward, that's something we all have to keep in our minds when we see all the, you know, new information come out, new sightings, because it definitely, like I say, what is flying today in the next 10 years is going to look very different than what we've seen flying for the last 50 years. And with that, depending on if they want that information disclosed or not, and on what level, always being able to default to like, oh, this guy saw a UFO, you know, what a jackass, you know. That is a really powerful tool for them to have in their tool bag if they need to deny or deflect when it comes to disclosing a certain program that may be sensitive.
Interesting. You have any thoughts on that, Vincent?
Well, like I said earlier, Martin, it's so difficult for people to keep a story straight. And if there is a program that said, hey, we're going to use this affinity for people to wonder about something and perpetuate that to hide what we're doing, it sounds fine and good. I guess if they must have done it pretty well, because you would think that it would be a little more known that, oh yeah, that for a while, look, that picture from Roswell or something, I don't know, is turned out to be an F-117 or turned out to be something else. There's still an element of this that suggests that not everything has been disclosed, and there are still some things that are being covered. And if so, good on them. But in my experience, it's been very difficult to keep secrets. Now, that being said, I am doing my best on my podcast to continue to keep the secrets that I've been privy to. And so I guess it's a little bit of a circular error or a circular argument I'm making, but I just feel like certain things are just difficult to keep covered up for very long when too many people are involved. So I don't know. Good one.
Well, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure as always, Mr. Willis. I deeply appreciate having a couple minutes to chat with you. You're a good friend, Tyler, as well. And Jella, we got to tie up again. It's been a long time since I saw you on the flight line at Whiting Field. And I look forward to looking at your website. So I'll have Martin do a connection first. And Tyler, I'm going to beg you to come on the show in not too distant future.
We'll make it happen.
All right.
All right. You guys be good. Congratulations. Happy 2019 to all of you.
All right. Same to you, Cobra. Take care.
Good night.
Tyler, I'm going to ask you, do you have a question for Vincent?
I don't have something off the top of my hands. I've talked to pilots so often, you know, I think I've gone through my Rolodex of questions a million times over. I think it's cool that he's interested in this because, you know, I think everybody, and when you asked me earlier about getting crap for reporting on UFOs, when there's not the topic that I do on a daily basis at all. And I truly believe that I've always had a fascination with the topic, and I'm a skeptic. You know, I'm not here to promote something as real because I have an intuition about. I need information. I'm still not sold on a lot of things. But that being said, I think anybody that's in the aerospace world, man, if they don't have an interest in this, if this isn't something at least they like, you know, they have just a tacit interest and think it's cool to think what if, you know, then that's somebody that I really haven't met. I mean, maybe they don't talk about it a lot, but it seems like there's always, you know, some sort of interest in it, but they don't talk about it. You know, it's something that they're not really apt to come out and say, hey, you know, I think this is even cool and I think it's worth talking about. And I've been, you know, like your other guests here, you know, I've been flying, you know, Hornets for X amount of years and I'm interested in it. And I think it's a cool topic to discuss. Breaking down those walls are going to be what's key. So, you know, I think it's really cool that you're here and that you're discussing it with us. And that's a really good step in the right direction in a lot of ways.
I will tell you this, Tyler, before he interviewed David Fravor, he basically had, you know, just thought that, you know, wackos saw UFOs. He had no idea, but because he knew David from before and then, you know, did an eye-to-eye interview, he totally, you know, believes that David saw something very unusual. And that's under-exaggerating it, really.
No, not at all. I believe there are people who saw things unusual, as you put it, and that they don't know what it is. I have no doubt about that. I'm certainly not prepared to say that they're wrong or to explain what they saw or to agree that it's from another universe or galaxy or whatever.
Yeah. And Tyler, can you just explain about, I believe you were the first one to get the radio recordings of an encounter. Can you remind me which one that was? Because I know there was one.
There were two.
Go ahead.
There was the Arizona one, and then there was the Oregon one. So the Oregon one was really unique because we just didn't get the ATC audio. Our FOIA request and some of the work we did ended up getting us a trove of information that was like unheard of. I mean, we had all the calls between FAA administrators and in real time. And we had a lot of investigations with the pilots, all the audio on it. So as well as the radar data and some of the staple stuff that you see. And the big takeaway I tell people on this, and then, like I say, it's something that's really not convenient for a lot of people that are really enthusiastic about this topic, is that it's very clear that the FAA, this is a very rare account, a rare occurrence for the FAA, something that's like seen by multiple people, that's happens over a long period of time, and where, you know, it can be investigated and the military is involved. it's not something that happens all the time. We know that because we have the calls with quality control back in D.C., and they don't even know how to classify what is really a very interesting event, but also a fairly basic event. So it's not like these are happening every day and everything, that, you know, they're covering all this up. It's rare. And that's what made that account and all that information we got so great, is because we know it was a rare event and we know so much about it.
Can you tell the story of what actually happened?
Yeah. So it was end of October, I think it was October 25th, 2017. There was a object that showed up on Oakland Center's radar, and they called it, you know, a fast mover. It was moving very, we don't know how fast really, but to the point that the ATC, the guy that was there at the terminal control, he was like stunned by it. And it was moving to the south, and it took a very hard right to the north and started speeding kind of toward the Oregon border. And by the time the sort of, you know, they reacted to it, this craft was flying kind of by Crater Lake area, Klamath Falls, Crater Lake area, and other aircraft, like three other aircraft, 737s, you know, airliners, pilots, were looking at it. And it was cruising along a little bit faster than they were, up in the flight levels above them, and they couldn't make it out what it was, aside from that it was white. And from the investigations, we know that the pilot said it was much larger than like a Learjet. It was the size of a large airliner. And this went on. It's not like they just saw it and disappeared. It continued on as they moved up the Willamette Valley. And by the time it sort of approached the Portland area, past Eugene, if you're familiar with kind of that I-5 corridor, the F-15s out of Portland, which, you know, is a top unit there, an air defense unit that has very good hardware, too. I mean, they're highly equipped for the Noble Eagle air sovereignty mission. They launched on alert. And by this time, these airplanes that were watching this thing, it was getting dark. So, that, you know, they were kind of losing it as it was, you know, the sun was setting. They were starting to descend into Portland. So this thing kept moving north by all accounts, and it was not tracked on radar past that first moment. Everybody was looking for it. The military was looking for it. The FAA was looking for it, and they could not see it. It didn't even show up as a primary on radar. So over that whole time, not intermittently, that whole time. And so by the time the F-15s went up and scrambled, they could only really set up a combat air patrol like just north of the city, kind of over Vancouver, and, you know, look around with it with their radars and see if they could find anything, and they couldn't find anything at all. And literally that is the story. I mean, with some, a lot of little details in between, but that is what happened, and it happened. It wasn't some balloon or anything like this. This was real. This happened. And the military, even NORAD, which we talked to, which is not subject to Freedom of Information Act requests. So a little bit different how you got to handle them and work with them. And usually they're really cool to work with. They were the first to tell me on the phone. They're like, hey, we don't know what it was. It was white. And we scrambled, couldn't find it. And eventually the FAA confirmed it, and that's when we ran with the story and started building it out. But what happened, once we got all the FAA information, it totally changed, and it became a much more deep event. You know, we could really feel how unique this was. And it was a really cool opportunity for us to pull back that curtain and really show people the reality of what this looks like. You know, not the TV version, not the movie version, really what happens when something is unidentified and detected in airspace and seen by multiple trained observers, people that have your and my lives in their hands on a daily basis, flying us around the United States. It was a really cool event, and we're very lucky to have the information we have on it.
Great. Wow. Very interesting. Well, I want to thank you, Vincent, for hanging in for extra time here. I really do appreciate it. And so people can check out your podcast and say it one more time how they can find it.
You're welcome, Martin. It's been fun being here with you today, and nice to meet Tyler Rogaway. My podcast is – thanks very much. It is fighterpilotpodcast.com.
Excellent. All right. Okay. Thanks a lot, Vincent. I really had a good time, and I appreciate you coming on the show.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
All right. Okay. So, Tyler, let's see. When a plane is actually like a commercial plane or even a private plane, do they have a transponder or some way to know that it's actually a plane instead of just an unknown?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. There's a transponder that gives them the altitude, the aircraft. Gives them basic information about what the aircraft is. Otherwise, without that, if that system is off, at best they have a primary contact, which usually just gives them a position. And a primary radar like that, it's not perfect. So even non-stealthy targets can be intermittent. Environmental factors and limitations of the gear, et cetera, can interfere sometimes with having a really steady blip on a radar of an aircraft, okay? But what made this so interesting is not only did it not have a transponder, and it was not communicating, because NORDO was not communicating with FAA aircraft controllers or any aircraft around it, but once it disappeared off radar after that first, that real fast move south over Northern California, it was gone. It did not exist on radar at all. They could not get it. And you hear in the tapes, the FAA and the military talking about trying to look for it, getting a primary return on it, and they can't. So what they did was they used the airliners in the vicinity to give them, updates and reports on what they could see. They're not like your past guest here. They're not in an F-18 or an F-15 where they go and check the thing out. I mean, they could, but that's not a good decision, especially when you don't know what it is, right? So you're limited sort of to, carry on your path, give us a report of what you see, and we'll try to keep a location on the object that way. So yeah, it was very much an eyewitness account after the first initial contact on radar, and it did not have a transponder, I don't believe, at that time either. There was no, I don't believe there was a transponder signal at the time.
And recently you did a really nice article. I don't know if it was you or your partner there, one of your coworkers wrote on the Irish encounter. Was that you that wrote that?
Yeah. And we were together. We did some quick research on that deal.
Yeah.
That was a wild one. I mean, that was one that, once again, trained observers. You have, when you talk about pilots, they're all great. I'm not saying that, that there's any difference really, but these are, international flights that are flying mainly. So, these are really experienced air crews that were flying, across the Atlantic to, go ahead to Europe or whatever, that saw this, craft and multiple angles of it or whatever it was. That was another one of those things that we've looked into afterwards, but we're dealing with, Ireland and their rules and everything else. It's a little bit different,
right,
than getting information out of it than, what we know here with the FAA, which is actually FAA is pretty cool about working with us. And I can't give those guys a high five enough, really, because they haven't generally, there's been some hiccups, but we had a thing even over Long Island. Another thing that I reported on that I found the air crew and talked to them about what they saw. That was a small airplane. Saw a very bright light over Long Island, very congested airspace. Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, the FAA usually, if it's not logged, like this Oregon thing was a bigger deal, but like the Arizona thing, that was my story. Everybody stole it, but that was us. We did that. We forensically recreated a flight and found out where it was, when it was, went to the FAA and said, we want the tape because we think that there was a sighting by multiple aircraft of an unidentified aircraft or flying object of some sort at very high altitudes, meaning above, at or above airliner traffic levels, the flight levels, 35,000 plus. Yeah. And, Albuquerque Center, the main guy there, boom. I mean, that audio immediately. And, they knew who we were, and they've been awesome.
Well, typical, or it has not. You probably know this, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step over what you were saying there, but it has been like pulling teeth when it comes to the FAA in the past. So I think that must be some type of change, or perhaps they just respect what you're doing and they will you know, they will be more lenient with you than they will, you know, the average Joe out there?
You know, I can't you know, answer that. I don't know for sure. But, you know, I just tell them, listen, you can give it to us or we can FOIA it and we can go through the process. I just don't want to waste your time doing that because it's just ATC audio. It's not, you know, it's not like classified material here that you need to be, you know, declassified. I'm just, you know, when it comes to all this, like, I followed this my whole life. I've been interested in it. And, you know, also because of the military side of it, right? Because in multiple ways, because sometimes what people see could be built, you know, defense projects and not, you know, UFOs in the classical sense. But I really going to tell you, like, the community hurts itself more than it helps itself in most ways. I hate to say it. I say this on every radio show I'm on, you know?
Yeah.
They just do. They don't, you know, instead of, I get a lot of correspondence from people about this topic, and a lot of it is very aggressive, very, you know, like, this is, you know, it's a viewpoint that they're only willing to look at. And I think that comes through as well when people want to go and talk to the government about it and say, hey, you know, we'd like to know more about this. It helps that I'm a defense writer and I know how that world works a little bit. And, you know, when they go to my site, they don't see UFOs. They see, you know, military news, defense news, technology news. Mm-hmm. All that goes into it, probably, you know. But it'd be nice if they treated everybody the same. But I'm going to tell anybody that's out there listens to your show that maybe has an incident that they're interested in and that they'd like to go and, you know, ask about, like, just be as professional as possible, you know. Mm-hmm. Be as respectful and professional as possible. Do not tell them what this was. Do not bring anything else into it. And I think you're going to have a better shot of them taking you seriously and getting some good data that maybe will change your perspective of what happened on that event. And there's also mm-hmm. many tools out there, guys, many tools out there now that there weren't, you know, 10 years ago when it comes to just tracking air traffic that you can use when you see something weird in the sky and you just want to say, gosh, what was that? Well, you can go to Flight Radar 24 and you can go and roll back, you know, all the transponder signals at that time in your area and visually see it. You know, I want to bring this up. I think this is really important. Debunking is the most powerful thing anybody can do on this topic. If you can go and say, this was a military aircraft, here's why, you're wrong, or this was a play on light, this is the most powerful tool. Because there's enough weird stuff that we have not been able to explain that if you waste time and try to push things that are explainable, it makes you uncredible.
You know what?
That's my...
You're my new friend because I feel exactly the same way. And, you know, a lot of people seem to bash the people that are actually have an explanation. I want to tell a real quick story about that. And that is in Utah, I believe it was Utah recently, there was some filmmakers filming with a drone, and they filmed this unusual object. And, you know, it went semi-viral, I'd have to say. And Mark D'Antonio, he's a video analyst. He's also a special effects guy and a friend. And he said, you know, I believe it's either a falcon or a hawk chasing the drone. And he went into all these different graphs. He was very thorough. And, you know, a lot of people came back and they said, well, you know what? I believe he's right. The bottom line is, wouldn't we rather know than... to carry on like you were saying, there's enough weird stuff out there to not have to worry about, you know, hanging on to the belief of something just because it's hard to identify at first.
Yeah, and everybody I found, there's a huge issue with this community that so many people want to have some special connection to it. They want to say, oh, this happened to me, and I had this experience, man. I have been shooting aircraft. I'm a photographer, you know, pretty well accomplished in this field, only aviation, okay? I've been looking in the sky with high-powered, high, you know, expensive gear at military bases around the United States for years, okay? Every aircraft you can imagine. And I've never seen one thing I could not explain, okay? Mm-hmm. Not one. Mm-hmm. And that's not saying that there aren't. I think there are, you know, obviously, I'm on your show. I think there are, and I report on these things. So there are. I'm just saying that, like, I get a lot of pushback from people that want to have their experience validated. And if you say anything that isn't, it's like you just mentioned that drone video, I said the exact same thing. Saw them on social media, Twitter. I said, man, it's a bird flying at the camera. I look at video all the time. It's not nothing. It was just like a little thing, a little sparrow or a hawk or something flying at the camera. Yeah, that's it. Move on, you know?
Yeah.
Instead, you know, it's aggressive. A real quick thing I want to share about this, and I think this validates everything that we're talking about. There was, I woke up one morning and there was all these tweets about a potential missile launch over Whidbey Island. I'm from the Pacific Northwest. Okay. That's up north of Seattle in Washington. Beautiful place in the Puget Sound there.
Oh yeah.
And
beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's this guy had a really nice weather station, right? Credible guy, not some weirdo guy that makes things up. And he caught something that looked really amazing on a weather station camera. And I first looked at it and I said, oh my God, that looks like a missile launch. Now, there's nothing up there that launches missiles. There's no rocket launches. People have no idea what it takes to actually pull that off or do that where it wouldn't be noticed by the whole community immediately. I mean, so immediately, this is what I do. I debunk. That's our job. That's our best post we do are debunk posts. So we leaped into it. And within 6 hours, I had totally solved that deal and had actually gone, found out the aircraft that flew over, talked to, had the business that owned it. It was an air ambulance helicopter, talked to the pilots to find the light configuration of the aircraft, and it all lined up, as well as just my knowledge of photography and doing time-lapse photography, you know, mastering that art, which is a hard art to master. Time-lapse night photography.
Wow.
So we totally debunked this. This was totally debunked. This was a helicopter that flew over, and it's an optical illusion on the camera with how it looks like a missile being launched. Okay? I mean, 100% I could recreate it if I had to. Okay? And the blowback was, like, worse than anything I've ever seen on any post, probably any political post I've ever done. It was threats. Being, you know, deep state, you can't imagine. and this wasn't UFO people. Okay. This wasn't the people that are into this topic. This was another subset that were mainly into this. But the reality is people don't like having what they think is something really special that they have an inside connection to being told it's not real and having evidence to support it. For the UFO community, that needs to be totally embraced. That should be the modus operandi, that if it can be thrown out in any way, it is. And we move on to those experiences, those things that happen that truly have no explanation, and that we know there could be something larger there.
Well, it's just
And the problem...
Go ahead. Sorry.
My final point is the problem is like I don't get paid to write books about UFOs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I get paid to report on stuff that is truthful. The best of my ability. Nobody's perfect. I do my very best, okay?
Yeah. Well, you know...
This community is infested with people that make money on it, perpetuate crap.
Yeah, that may be a little bit... There's a few that make money on it. There's not too many people that make money on it. There's a lot of people trying to, but that always can muddy the water and make things more sensational, and, you know, I've seen some cases.
Well, it could be because you're successful. It could be that you're just really good at your job and you do a great job. You deserve all the money in the world.
Yeah.
But where I have a problem with is when I see guys that are very good at this, that are very big names in this community. They're on TV a lot, okay? And they push stuff that if I didn't have the knowledge I do about the history of clandestine programs, especially out of Area 51, man, I would believe this. I would say, my gosh, this is amazing. This is a deathbed confession of UFOs and the Lockheed Skunk Works is involved. And I would believe it 100%. It's that good. But when you go to a specialist looks at it, it's absolute crap. It's just junk. It's just perpetuating a bunch of stuff found online that doesn't even line up with things that we know about in history. So I'm passionate about this because I think that if this is ever to be taken seriously and people are ever to be engaged and we actually get somewhere with this topic, we're going to need to be skeptics first and believers second.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter where the cards fall, maybe the answer isn't what you wanted. The truth is what matters.
That's right. And there were, you know, I'll point this out, in Project Blue Book, out of the 10,000 cases, there were 700 that they just could not explain. And so there is enough out there. Now, I would suggest not to use the word debunk so much. explain is actually a better word for it. Debunking, I think, you know, even though you're using it properly, it has kind of a bad connotation. And but when you're explaining something that, you know, what I consider debunking that phrase used more for if someone is hoaxing. And then you can debunk that it's a hoax, you know, that type of thing. But when you explain something that's unidentified, that's to me, you know, being skeptic and taking a real look at it, making sure you're understanding what it is. You know, I agree wholeheartedly that, you know, whatever the truth, whatever the evidence actually leads, that's what it really is, and why try to pretend it's anything else.
Yeah, and I think you're totally right on terminology. I think we need to, people that are interested in this have to work together to come up with good terminology, right, that isn't insulting to people. We don't want people not to come forward. We don't want people not to share, you know, unique experiences. This is just from my reaction from being somebody that has taken the risk to go into this realm, and it's been 100% good. I've never had, one thing I've never had with some of the crazy emails and correspondence and everything else that's come from this, I've never had anybody question me, or like it's never damaged anything that I do or anything like that. You mentioned that at the very start of the show, and like I say, if it's done right, if you work this topic correctly and you just go after the facts and you just display them for people and you just, you know, let that fall where it may, it's a totally different reaction than predisposition and talking like basically to acquire. I want to get people interested in the topic that aren't, you know, that's my goal, you know, is to get people that say, oh man, this is junk. And you know, this is all just stuff, Men in Black movie, you know, Hollywood stuff. Mm-hmm. I like to have people open their mind a little bit, you know, and it seems to work. So there is a way to do it, I really believe. And to other reporters out there that stay away from it, you know, or always write a report about it with a laugh at the end, which is what we see mainly, yes. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not reporting.
Yeah.
You know, you should never have written that report if it's a joke.
That's right.
You should have never done that, you know.
And that's just the same way in, you know, a news report where at the end they'll play X-Files music, you know, the same thing, same type of way. Yeah. Leslie Kane, I speak with her, you know, fairly often recently as well. And she, are you familiar with who Leslie Kane is?
I'm not. No.
She wrote a really good book called, I'm going to get this wrong because I just do that, Generals, Pilots, and... she's a journalist. She actually is one of the three that broke the story of the in December 16th about the Pentagon's search for UFOs. Her.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, I know who you're talking about. Yes, yeah. I'm very aware of her work.
Yeah,
she's done some other stuff. She did an Area 51 book, I believe. Is that the same person?
No, the one her book that really she's known for the most is Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, UFOs, and the forwards by John Podesta. So that's the one she's mostly known for, but she shares exactly what you were saying as far as the philosophy about approaching this subject very, very carefully. And she has been, you know, trying to work with people in Washington, and she's extremely careful. And I brought this up also with Vincent ahead of you, and that is the term is used UAP. Instead of UFOs, because of, you know, UFOs seem to be associated with the little green men and, you know, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's definitely a connotation there. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one thing I was really afraid to use. I'll be totally honest with your listenership here. When I started, you know, taking the risk to do this stuff, I said, man, I just can't put UFO in there. You know, I just can't do it. And after... after a couple of the pieces, I think the Arizona piece was the one that I did. I used it, and I thought, I'm going to get pushback from this. I got none, because it's what matters are the facts. Right. If you don't sell it as something, if you don't try to make a conclusion, you know, people can overlook even, you know, bad terminology or anything else. But yeah, that's definitely part of it, you know. You know, but also we're living in a time now where, you know, we have this the To the Stars thing happening. There's a lot going on with that. I'm very interested in, skeptical about. And, you know, we're going to be working on that a little bit in the future.
Yeah, what's your...
you know, it's good that there's...
I hear... I get a lot of email about To the Stars Academy with varied opinions. And one of my listeners is actually... he toured with Blink for several years, and he's a friend of Tom DeLonge's, and said, "You want me to get him for the show?"
Yeah.
He won't. He won't be on the show. I mean, that he's told not to do any shows after he did one with Joe. Who am I thinking of?
Joe Rogan.
Rogan. Yes. Yeah. I watched that. So
it was not good.
It was not good. It didn't help them any. As an outsider, someone that's not actually in the UFO field, what do you think about in general about what they're trying to do there?
Hey, listen, I think it's cool that they're interested in this topic. You know, I think it's good for Tom too. You know, he found a passion that he wants to explore, and that's everything in life, right? So, you know, I'm nothing about the people involved, and they all seem like, man, they've got great people on that team. Everything else, but you know, I just am skeptical about a lot of things that how it came about, and you know, I really don't want to say too much this time because it's something that we're going to be developing in the future. It's just to me it seems a bit odd. But in fact, even the ATIP program seems very odd, and it goes, there's some common themes that run from that ATIP, the origins of the ATIP program, through the To the Stars Academy and that whole backstory and on, that I find very interesting and I think need to be looked into. But we'll see what happens. You know, they've claimed a lot, haven't seen anything. If I had material from a spacecraft, potentially, you know, something that we keep hearing, or some unknown material, man, I'm taking that under guard to a lab, getting basic results done, and if they're abnormal, I am disclosing that immediately to major networks.
Well, you know what I mean? Have,
I'm not.
We have, pardon me, we have someone actually listening to the show right now that I know is involved in something like that we are going to know about this year, the results of what they determine, which I think is fascinating. You know, of course, we all have to be skeptic until, you know, and just because something's unusual doesn't mean that it came from outer space. But it could. Yeah. I mean, there's possibilities.
It could. It just, I think there's delivering, needs to deliver more now, you know, because there's been just a lot of hype about it. There's just, they've hyped themselves up a lot, which is great. Listen, I don't want to be critical of them and their operation like that. I'm just telling you stuff that red flags for me from being a journalist, you know, doing what I do, you know. It's just stuff that doesn't make sense. Lots of big claims that, you know, that there's all this stuff in hand. Things take time. I understand that for sure. But, you know, it'd be nice to see more. Beyond that, I think that as far as the To the Stars idea, you know, I'm got a problem with the name. I got a problem with the fact that they're winding entertainment into it.
Yes,
that really destroys credibility to me. And I get it. You need to pay for this stuff.
It is. A lot of people think that's very strange. Yes. You're not alone in that thought. But, they do have to raise funds. Now, we only have about a minute and a half here, or just over a minute. Can you just, for the listener out there, can you tell them some of the stories that you have reported on in a quick nutshell that you can get done in about a minute?
I mean, for this whole world that we're talking about, definitely the Oregon sighting, that is follow-up on that, the FAA. The Arizona one was pretty big. We did the Long Island one, and we've stayed pretty good on this, the Nimitz encounter in 2004 with the, you know, so-called Tic Tac. We're probably going to be revisiting that, but I'm really, there's so many people that are on that. I'm going to be recapping more than anything else. But there's some interesting areas. The main thing I get asked is, do you think this thing is extraterrestrial? You guys, I'm just going to leave your audience with this. The government has spent billions and billions and billions of dollars a year in black budget programs for the better part of a century. Okay. eventually you're going to get some really incredible technology out of that. And some of that stuff is not going to be, probably so incredible you don't want to even use it, okay? So keep your mind open that it, even these extreme capabilities that these craft are supposedly able to do, I'm not here to tell you, like, people say, oh, we don't have it. I, from, like, looking into this particular world, like the Black Project world for so long, there's no way I can tell you that.
Right.
In fact, I would say,
Tyler, we have to have you on again. It's too short. We're out of time. So, hey, thanks so much. And you go to the Drive or the War Zone. They can find your stories, right?
Absolutely. And hey, thanks for dealing with the, like I said, the Kermit the Frog and the heavy breathing here. So next time I'll be a little bit clearer for you.
All right. All right, Tyler. Thanks so much. And I'll talk to you soon.
You got it. Have a good one.
All right. You too.
Bye-bye.
All right, everyone. So that's it for the show. I want to thank everyone that's helped out with the show. And also next week, we're going to be talking more about this. We're going to have Robert Powell on talking about the Nimitz. I want to also thank you, the listener, and people over at YouTube and over at the Dark Meadow Digital Network, everyone. And remember, keep your eyes to the sky.